You are listening to Legacy Talks. I am your host, Sasha Lund. Following in someone else's footsteps is never easy, especially if these footsteps belong to a family business. I have set out on a quest to help family members and businesses navigate the complexities of their intergenerational wealth. In Legacy Talks, each week I have intimate conversations with leading members from multi-generational family businesses. I want to know what sets successful family businesses apart from the failing ones. Together with my guests, we explore the successes and pitfalls that make or break a legacy. Welcome to Season 2 of Legacy Talks. Did you know there is such a thing as smart luck? And did you know that you can actually contribute greatly to creating your own luck? Sounds a bit too good to be true, right? Well, I'm excited to tell you that it is indeed possible. In today's Legacy Talks episode, I am joined by Dr. Christian Busch. He is the best-selling author of Connect the Dots, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck, a book that has been highly praised by people such as Arianna Huffington, Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn, and Brent Hoberman, founder of LastMinute.com. Christian is a member of the World Economic Forum's Expert Forum, a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and on the Thinkers 50 radar list of the 30 thinkers most likely to shape the future. Needless to say, we have a highly interesting conversation. Christian and I discuss the concept of good luck and how business families and family businesses can create a serendipitous mindset that can lead to stronger and more successful companies and happy family members and employees. Enjoy. Welcome to season 2 of Legacy Talks. And I am extremely excited to have a friend of mine with me today, someone whom I admire highly, Dr. Christian Busch. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christian, we are going to talk about serendipity mindset, the art and science of creating good luck. Now, you are the best-selling author of the book, Connect the Dots, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck. And Arianna Huffington said about the book, and I'm quoting, a wise, exciting, and life-changing book. Having read it myself, I can only concur. You are also an internationally known expert in the areas of innovation, purpose-driven leadership, and serendipity. Further, you are the director of the CGA Global Economy Program at NYU. And you teach at LSE, London School of Economics, in the UK. Christian, I want to start with, a very basic question. What is serendipity?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because at the end of the day, I think a lot of times when we think about luck, we think about things that happen to us, right? Being born into a nice family that's loving and things like that. But actually, you know, serendipity is about smart luck. It's about luck that we create ourselves. Based on our own decisions in moments of uncertainty, of the unexpected. And so, you know, take as an example, one of my favorites is the potato washing machine. And, you know, so imagine you there's this company in China and they produce refrigerators, washing machines and so on. And one day they got calls from farmers. And the farmers told them, your crappy washing machine is always breaking down. And so they asked, well, why is it breaking down? Well, we're trying to wash our potatoes in it and it doesn't seem to work. And so in that unexpected moment now, right, usually what we would probably do is to say, well, don't wash your potatoes in there. It's not made for that. Our marketing plan says don't wash potatoes in it, like just wash your clothes. They did the opposite. They said, you know what, that's unexpected, but there's probably a lot of farmers in the world who might have a similar problem. So why don't we build in a dirt filter and make it a potato washing machine? And when you think about up to 50% of innovations, inventions that happen serendipitously, when you think about how maybe you unexpectedly found your job, how maybe unexpectedly you found the love of your life, a lot of times, yes, there's some kind of degree of randomness, there's some kind of unexpected event, but then it's about us imbuing meaning in this. It's about us connecting the dots and doing something meaningful with it. And that's really what I'm fascinated about. And the question of the science-based framework behind that cultivation of that kind of smart luck.
That's fantastic. Well, when you said that example with the Chinese farmers, for me, that sounds more like being agile and being able to, you know, have that adaptive mindset. So how do you then kind of put those two frameworks together, being agile and being serendipitous, having serendipity. I don't even know what verb to use.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because if you think about it in terms of different Venn diagrams type, right, you know, being agile is great because then, you know, you reframe situations when you're in them and you try to understand how do you, you know, get the best out of it. I think that's a big element. But I think that the core gist of a kind of serendipity mindset is really to say, how do you always see a little bit more in a moment, especially when it's unexpected? And how do you then connect that to something meaningful and do something beautiful out there? And a lot of times, actually, that comes to very deeper psychological questions. You know, so take the example, right? You're in a coffee shop and if you have erratic hand movements like I do, you spill coffee over someone and you spill coffee over them and they look at you slightly annoyedly, but you sense there might be something there. You don't know what it is. You just sense there might be something there. And now you have two options, right? Option number one is you just say, oh, I'm so sorry. You walk outside and you think, ah, what could have happened had I spoken with that person? Option number two, you start a conversation. That person becomes the love of your life, your co-founder, you name it. The point here is that our reaction to that unexpected moment, a lot of times is held back by our self-limiting beliefs, right? So it might be, I don't feel worthy yet. I don't feel that person will appreciate it. I don't feel X, Y, Z. And so a lot of times, you know, same when you're sitting in a meeting and you have this unexpected idea that comes and you might not raise it because you feel, you know, you're not ready, you're an imposter, whatever it is. That actually a lot of times keeps us from that kind of serendipity. And I think so that mindset work is also a lot around saying, how do we overcome those self-limiting beliefs that we have? And that then also set us up to really kind of live a life in which we have much more serendipity happen. Because, you know, one of the things that our work shows a lot is people tend to miss serendipity all the time. They tend to just, you know, there's so much in the world that could have happened, but it didn't, because people might not act on that situation, because people might not, you know, when you take another street to work and you see something in the bookstore and you think, ah, that could be a new book. If you don't open your eyes to it, if you're just on your phone, for example, you don't see those opportunities for serendipity. And then you think back and you think, ah, what could have happened? And that's one of the biggest deathbed regrets, right? The idea of what could have happened. And I think when it comes to serendipity, there's so much potentiality that can happen.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I find it fascinating that there is actually a framework behind this. And it's not just, oh, okay, let's see. Let's hope we're lucky. But there is an actual framework behind it. How did you end up being so fascinated with this?
Well, it's very serendipitously so, actually. I used to be that kid in high school. I was kicked out of high school, had a repeated year, was the nightmare of any parent you can imagine. And then transferred this into my driving style, probably held the unofficial world record of how many dustbins and trash cans you can knock over on your way to school when you're driving. And then one day wasn't so lucky anymore and crashed into four parked cars, all of them completely destroyed, including my own. And one of the key kind of themes that I've had for a very long time was the sentence that a policeman said to me when he came to the scene. He was like, oh my God, he's still alive. And so that idea that I was supposed to be dead, that stuck with me. And, you know, I asked myself a lot of weird questions like, who would have come to my funeral? Who would have actually cared? Was it all worth it? And at that point, I only had depressing answers. And so that took me on this intense search for meaning, trying to figure out, you know, what is life all about? Is there something that I can do that really gives me meaning? And what I realized is that what I enjoy doing the most is connecting ideas, connecting people. And so I started out as community builder and then later entrepreneur and social entrepreneur and then went into academia. And what I found fascinating is that the most inspiring, joyful, purpose-driven people around me, they seem to have something in common, which is that they intuitively cultivate serendipity. They just have a little bit of more of this like, oh my God, such a coincidence type thing in their life. And so that's kind of where the fascination came from, where it's been both my own kind of life philosophy and, you know, daily practice almost. But at the same time, also, I've seen it with so many people that have been doing really interesting things. And so the question was, what is the pattern behind this? Is there something that, even though the stories are so different, the love story of XYZ person to the social entrepreneur in Uganda, but actually, when you look at the underlying pattern, it's always the same, where there's some kind of unexpected moment. And then the question, what do they do with it? And then how do they turn that into something positive? But also, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, we can create more of those unexpected moments. And I think that's where it gets really exciting.
Oh, that's very exciting. I want to hear more about that for sure. Let me just go back one step, though, because you said in the end of the day, there is always something that is the same. And I think in a way, it doesn't matter social status, academic status. In the end of the day, we're all human beings, right? And I think searching for meaning and understanding the purpose of life are these very deep and philosophical questions that we all have. Even if we sometimes don't want to admit it to ourselves, we do at one point of time, we will always ask ourselves that. And personally, I ask myself that probably way too often. But with the families that I have the privilege to work with, I have noticed a very interesting shift. Maybe it's not a shift. Maybe it's just the fact that people talk about it more. But especially with the next generation, I noticed that they are really trying to wrap their heads around these deep questions and maybe also how to combine them with where they come from and finding their own purpose. And from what I hear from you, since serendipity actually seems to be a mindset, can you tell us a bit about maybe a couple of ways how you can actually cultivate serendipity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, serendipity is a lot about potentiality, right? It's about what could be, where you could be, who you could be, and so on. And so what I find fascinating about this, you know, I've always been intrigued, and whoever is listening, if you're interested in this, I would Google deathbed regrets. And when you Google deathbed regrets, what will come up is a Guardian article or so that will talk about the work of some nuns who ask people on their deathbed, what do you regret the most in your life? And what a lot of people will say is, I would have loved to have built more meaningful relationships in my life. I would love that I had lived up to who I could really have been in terms of like my core values, that I actually, because I always kind of lived the life of someone else, and those kind of things. And, you know, to me, that's really at the core of this in terms of saying, okay, if you like, the more you are anchored in yourself in terms of knowing who you want to be or who you could be, the more actually you can connect dots to those things that feel meaningful, because you look at situations and you think, ah, how could that relate to X, Y, Z thing that I'm excited about? And so I'm actually a big fan of thinking about, you know, doing a serendipity journal where you write down, what are three or four things in my life that are deeply meaningful to me, right? I think there's a lot of times the pressure to kind of find a purpose or things like that. And I think, you know, if someone finds that, amazing. But I think a lot of people, especially when you're younger, you might not have that kind of purpose, and it might be very difficult to find that. And so I'm a big fan of finding curiosities, finding things where you're saying, this is a curiosity I have about life. This is something that I want to learn about life. And a lot of times, you know, if you think about it in the family business, maybe it might be something, hey, like maybe there's a curiosity if you could take that family business into a completely different direction that seems more meaningful to you in terms of sustainability or whatever it is. And then really kind of like thinking about these interest areas and thinking about, how can I now bring that into different conversations in a very non-pushy way, in a very kind of way that allows other people to connect the dots for it and come with ideas? So for example, there's an amazing entrepreneur in London called Ollie Barrett. And if you would ask Ollie this dreaded what do you do question that kind of puts people into boxes and you know, he wouldn't just say, I'm a technology entrepreneur. He would say, I'm a technology entrepreneur, recently read into the philosophy of science, but what I'm really excited about is playing the piano. And so what he's doing here is he's giving you three potential hooks where you could be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. We're hosting piano sessions. You should stop by. Oh my God, such a coincidence. My sister is teaching on the philosophy of science. You should give a guest lecture. The point is, the more we can bring those hooks into conversation in a kind of side sentence, the more then actually unexpectedly the aunt's friend of yours might pick up and say, oh my God, such a coincidence. Our family business just did X, Y, Z thing. So maybe we can like bring that into yours or whatever it is. The point is, we can increase this opportunity space for potential serendipity by letting people know about things that we're excited about in a very non-obtrusive, in a non-kind of intrusive way. There's a lot of other things, but I'm really a big fan of those kind of small behavioral shifts in terms of how do we set these hooks, but also, you know, how do we allow other people to tell us more about what they're really excited about? Because I think a lot of times what happens is, you know, if we ask those questions like, what do you do? Or so we put people into boxes, right? I mean, imagine you go on a holiday to Italy, a beautiful fishing village, and there's this kind of woman or man that sits on the beach and you ask them, what do you do? And they say, well, I'm a fisherwoman. Now, most of us might then say, well, there's probably not a lot I have in common with that person because, you know, their like life is very different from mine. But if you would ask them more around, you know, what is it about fishing that you enjoy? What is it like, what is it that kind of like gives like, you know, you some kind of joy in that? They might say something like, well, I love the endlessness of the sea. And then you might be like, yeah, this is exactly what I love about philosophy, or this is about what I love about books, or you name it. So the point is, the more we ask different types of more open-ended questions that allow other people to tell us more about what they're actually excited about, the more we will find these unexpected overlaps where we might be like, oh my God, I didn't even realize X, Y, Z. We should set up something around this. Oh my God, X, Y, Z experience. So long story short, I think the more we can think both about what could we be about, less kind of forcing it and more kind of like naturally saying, these are a couple of areas I'm interested in, the more then actually we allow serendipity to also take us a little bit into that kind of direction that we could be, that we can't even know of. We can't plan that all out.
That's amazing. And I'm listening to you and I just keep being reminded of all the conferences I go to where it's always very, in a way, in a box. What do you do? What's your degree? And it's you limit yourself by asking that. And I feel actually, especially when you go to conferences, to summits, to gatherings like that, you actually have so many opportunities to get to know people on a much deeper level and see where you can connect the dots.
Absolutely.
Now, business dynasties, they need to constantly think about their legacy, right? So my question would be, how can one get fit for the future, since you are an expert on that in a way? How can one get fit for the future, both as a business family and a family business? And is there maybe a specific mindset that is required to be able to thrive in today's world, which is very fast-paced and it's rapidly changing? It's exhausting at times.
Well, what's interesting, I think, is so a lot of our work on the research side is about the question of how do purpose-driven companies survive and thrive in this world. And so we just finished a study, for example, with over 40 top CEOs of large companies at the Masterclass of the world, who said, okay, how do we take this big company and then make it more purpose-driven or make it have more impact and so on? And one of the things that I've been fascinated by is that idea of, and to your point of legacy, that idea of how do we, quote unquote, modernize legacy while keeping deeply ingrained in our tradition and at the same time really kind of thinking about what are the big issues now in the world that we just want to be relevant to and really be part of. And so one thing that I've seen in companies like MasterCard, for example, is that they say, okay, you know, we used to be at about financial transactions and, you know, payment systems, but nobody gets that excited about that, right? Like to be honest. And so essentially, and it doesn't really do, I mean, it does interesting things in the world, but also, you know, if you work for a MasterCard, then you would be like, well, okay, that's okay, but not so exciting. But essentially what Ajay Banga did a couple of years ago, the then CEO, he said, you know what? We know that one of the biggest problems in the world is financial exclusion, that people in poverty don't have access to the financial system, and then they can't really build their business. They can't really do anything in terms of lifting themselves out of poverty. And so he said, look, our bigger idea now is we want to be part of bringing 500 million people into the financial system. And so what he did here is to say, let's identify our core capability, which is we're really good with financial transactions and so on. And at the same time, the big societal problem that's out there, which is financial exclusion, and then saying, okay, here's a strategy that leads us there. But the exciting thing that he did, and I think that's what a lot of the people that seem extremely successful around this do, is that they set this kind of North Star. They set this sense of direction that somehow is based on the legacy, but also on the future, being in sustainable development goals or other things. And then really say, here's an approximate strategy, but I need everyone to be part of this, and the unexpected will be part of the plan. And I think that's really the biggest shift in terms of mindset, that old school leadership mindset is I have to plan everything, I have to know everything, and so on, right? And then kind of like the unexpected happens and it seems like a threat to our authority, a threat to our business, a threat to everything. And what smart companies are doing is that they say, let's build that into that. And by doing this, we both enable people to come with their ideas, but also to actually survive. And to give an example, maybe also, I found that fascinating here in the US, you know, when COVID happened. And when COVID happens, a lot of the state, like the people who have the power in the states, being the governors or others, they were very much in the old school leadership style of saying, hey, like, here's an exact timeline of when we will open up the state again, right? So like, here's exactly the strategy. Now, you set yourself up for failure, right? Because you can't know when there's a new outbreak. You can't know when like new information comes in. And so the problem with this old school leadership mindset is, A, you either now hide new information because you feel it could threaten your authority, that you have to revise your timeline, or you have to revise the timeline and you look weak. Now, on the other hand, though, the new type of leadership style is to say, okay, here's our principles or our North Star, which is public health and economic health. here's an approximate timeline, but we are telling you now from the beginning that as soon as new information comes in, we will adjust the timeline. And what you're doing here is now when you're adjusting the strategy, when you're adjusting the timeline, you look strong because actually now people feel, oh, that person follows through with what they told us. That is always what was part of the plan. And so long story short, I've seen exactly the same in small businesses, large businesses, and in people's lives, that once you redefine the unexpected from just being a threat to actually, no, that is part of what we're doing and it has to be part of what we're doing because the world is changing too fast, then actually we don't see it as a threat only. We also see it as an ally sometimes for innovation, for new type of ideas, because as we all know, real innovation comes from pressure. It comes from crisis. As you know, they beautifully say, right, this idea that you should never waste a good crisis because that's actually when change can happen.
That's true. That's beautifully said. I'd like to kind of pick up on that idea of the North Star and set kind of the listeners who have been following Legacy Talks and also the families I work with know that I am a big believer in living and breathing family constitutions, meaning living and breathing, meaning, you know, no old book on a dusty bookshelf, but an actual set of ideas and guidelines. I don't want to say rules, but guidelines that everyone subscribe to and also follow. In an ideal world, which is not often the case, but in an ideal world, family members are then aligned with the values, with the vision, and with the mission, right? So let's say for a second that we have a family that has reached that level of alignment. The vision, the mission, they're all clear. And now back to the North Star. How do we actually go about implementing these changes and these innovative ideas in order for these values to be materialized? Because it's all beautiful in an abstract way, but how do we actually act upon it?
Yeah, it's a great question because to your point, I think it's at the core of actually holding things together, right? To be able to commit to and to believe in a kind of common set of, you know, being in values, principles, whatever it is. And then at the same time, I think one of the biggest issues I've seen both in family businesses and more generally is in a way that there's something on paper, but then in the day-to-day, if you would go into the office on Monday morning, you don't feel it, right? Because yes, like we always say, we want to be innovative in XYZ, but actually then every idea gets shot down and XYZ, right? And so that's the worst thing then. That's actually even worse than, right, than having a write-up like this when you in a way have something that says one thing and then in the day-to-day something else happens. Like that gives us a lot of cognitive dissonance, right? And so I'm a big fan of really for every value or principle or anything that is being defined as something we believe in, like the shorter the better, right? So that people actually can remember what was in there. But also then for each of them having a key practice, something that is directly integrated in the day-to-day. So if we're, for example, saying that curiosity, just for the sake of it, is one of our core values, and we will always be curious and innovative around that. Well, then how does that show in your performance review? How does that show in your promotion policy? How does that show in how you organize your meetings? And really kind of integrating that into that. And I think one of the things I'm very excited about, you know, when doing that kind of work is that it's not about reinventing everything. It's not about saying we have to do everything differently. It's just about saying no, like do small changes. If you, for example, have a quote unquote value like curiosity related something to that, then okay, maybe in the weekly meeting, there should be a question that asks, what surprised you last week? And then by doing this, what happens is you legitimize the idea of curiosity. You legitimize the idea of that unexpected things will happen. You make people aware that there might be potential potato washing machines out there that are still to be discovered and that you can't plan for. And, you know, there's fascinating research around that once you actually ask people to look out for the positively unexpected, they see it much more often and they come up with more innovation, for example, because they start seeing it when it's there. It's like the same thing, you know, there's all these experiments around how people find more money in the street when they consider themselves to be lucky because they believe it's there. And that's not about kind of some woohoo type thing, but that's actually about your level of alertness, right? If you're alert to the positively unexpected, you start to see it more. And I mean, I find a lot of money in the street, unfortunately, mostly pennies, so that doesn't really help. But you know, that like I expect it to be there because I know how much people drop, right? Like I drop a lot, so other people will also drop a lot, right? And so it's kind of, once you expect the unexpected, the positively unexpected, it starts to happen much more. But so the long story short to your question really is, I'm a big fan of that kind of like formulating those kind of umbrellas and you know, kind of whatever one calls it, constitutions or whatever it is. But then I think for each of the kind of key points, there needs to be a translation that is in the day to day. So not only once a year something at an annual meeting, but actually like in the day to day.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I think, well, you know, when I was reading your book and I read that example with the money, I was actually laughing first and said, well, you know, it's easier said than done. Just say, okay, you have to kind of force yourself to be more open-minded. How do you actually do that? But then I noticed that it automatically happened by itself to me when I bought a new car. And suddenly I thought I was the only one. And suddenly I see my car, everyone driving my car, because I'm suddenly more alert to the fact that other people in the street have my car. So I find that it's very interesting how it actually will just slowly develop. But I do, I urge everyone who's listening to buy Christian's book, because it's really eye-opening and life-changing, which is very exciting. I'd like to go back to the word mindset. Again, it's a very abstract word, right? But I have noticed through interactions with others and also on my own, like by myself, that a positive mindset is key to open and successful communication. Now, we know that communication is something many of us struggle with, especially when we don't feel that we can speak up or because we lack the sense of trust, right? But by reading your book, I realized that we can train ourselves to be more serendipitous in our interactions and in general in life. So please, could you elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And to your point, there's a lot of ways we can take to make that happen. But I'm a big fan of a couple of things. For example, like thinking about in every conversation that I have, what I'm trying to think about is there some kind of introduction I can make, or is there some kind of idea I can connect this to? And when you do that a couple of times, then you think about, okay, how does that what they tell me to relate to something else? And just being generous about it, the more actually then beautiful things happen, right? That like you might sense that someone might need to be in touch with someone else. You don't really know exactly why yet, but you just say, feel like, okay, they should be in touch. And then, you know, kind of you start connecting those dots. And that's really about neuroplasticity, right? That's about how our brain, once we ask our brain to look at situations from a kind of connect the dots type perspective, it starts actually doing that more. And so I'm a big fan of starting with these kind of small things, of really thinking about, How can I be an active listener? How can I be someone when you tell me something, I want to understand, you know, what is behind that? Like when you tell me something, I want to learn more about you. And the more we have this genuine interest in the other, the more we ask genuinely interested questions, it's fascinating that no conversation can be boring, right? I sometimes have these people who come and say, oh, I just came from this boring dinner. And I'm usually saying, look, this is on you. Like this, like I can, like, seriously, even the most boring person in the world, like if you would think about the most boring person in the world, let's say, I don't know, I don't even want to stereotype who might be the most boring people in the world, but let's say you meet that most boring person in the world, they still have something probably in common with you, right? So they might also have lost a brother to cancer, or they might have gone through an identity crisis when they were 19, or, and so there's always something there that we cannot know. And if we don't allow that to be known, because we don't ask questions that guide us there, then we will never know. And so I'm a big fan, actually. I used to veer on extremes, right? So I used to kind of, whenever I would go to an event, for example, I used to ask questions like, what makes you come alive is the first question. And of course, like some people love it, right? Because they're like, oh my God, finally someone asked me like a proper question. And then others might be like, wow, this is like a big question. Like I need some time for this. And so I've kind of gone a little bit away from the kind of like over, hey, you have to directly think about something big, to like more kind of the gradual, what I mentioned earlier with the fisherwoman, in terms of like, what is it that you enjoy about this? Or why do you do this? Or, you know, just something that in a kind of very like slow way allows others to open up a little bit about it. And again, I think then it gets really exciting, because then we realize how much we all have in common, like with the most kind of different people that are around there. And then I think in combination with kind of casting a couple of hooks that just, you know, in a nice, genuine way, allow other people to just say, yeah, this is what I'm most interested in. I think that kind of like then organically guides us into a direction of good conversation and gets there. But to me, it really comes in the end of the day back to that usually in life, what we expect we get, right? A lot of times. So if you assume bad intention in someone, if you assume that they are boring, most likely you will have a boring conversation, because that's essentially what you're expecting. And that's how you're guiding it, versus if you're coming in and assume that the other person will have something interesting to say, you just have to somehow kind of like, in a way, bring it up. then like I think it gets everything gets much more joyful and exciting.
So in the end, trust your gut, have an open heart and open mind, and ask interesting questions. If you connect these dots, you have serendipity. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting what you're saying about the gut, right? Because I think one of the things that I've seen, especially with very senior leaders, is that they have an extremely good mature gut feeling, right? So they have something where they quote unquote trust their gut, but it took them some time to learn how to trust it. Because it's one thing to trust your gut when it's kind of like a naive gut feeling, right? Where you're like fight or flight. Like then it's actually really bad to trust your gut, right? When you're kind of like in a fight or flight and you just out of fear do something. But then actually when you kind of realize, and I think that's why I'm a big fan of this informed gut feeling, where you're saying, okay, let me listen to my gut and what it tells me. And if it tells me, for example, in a meeting that actually, you know, that seemed to have gone really well and we wanted to put some money into something, but then kind of my gut tells you, for some reason, I don't trust that person 100%. Like then essentially a naive person might either just directly say, no, I won't invest, or kind of might still invest, whatever, right? A mature gut feeling person would say, okay, let me get now every information I can get. Like, let me understand, like, let me ask two more people for a reference about them. Let me understand five more things about them. And then it might turn out that they have messed over other people. So of course, never invest. Or it might turn out that that was just because they had a really bad morning, because some, like their child was sick and they were just in a weird mood. But next time you connect very differently. And so my point here is that learning how to trust our gut in a way that we inform it as much as possible with as much information we can get, that kind of leads us then, I think, to a gut feeling that we can trust more, because it's guiding us a little bit, but we're not over trusting it, especially in situations of fear.
Wonderful. I actually couldn't agree more. I think that's what guides me in life. And it's not always easy, because you need to find exactly that balance that you're talking about. On a final note, if you could summarize connecting the dots, what are the main takeaways you would like to leave the listeners with?
Well, I think it comes back to Viktor Frankl. So it's a book that I highly recommend to everyone. I read it a lot when I had that car accident. I read it recently again 2 years ago. I had COVID very early on that nearly killed me. And I read it again because, you know, it just felt like it's those kind of situations where inherently there's no meaning in them. Inherently, there's nothing. It feels very tense. But that book, in a way, has been a book that essentially is all about how do you still find some kind of meaning in tough circumstances. And one of the beautiful things that Viktor Frankl kind of in his thoughts talked a lot about is the idea that you cannot always pick the situation, but you can always pick the response to it. You cannot always influence that, you know, if COVID happens and you run a brewery, that really is bad, right? Because most of your customers, like restaurants or so, will just not be there anymore. Mm-hmm. So that situation itself is really bad. But now what's your response to it? Is your response that you just fire people and that's it? Or that you maybe say, wow, we can use our hand sanitizer and we can use our alcohol and produce hand sanitizer and become a hand sanitizer company. And so it's our response to that unexpected moment that shapes in a way a lot of what comes next. And so I'm a big fan of that in a way the unexpected is the moment where our true colors show. It's the moment where if you put people into unexpected situations, especially negatively unexpected situations, crisis situations, it shows you their real character, but it also shows you who's really kind of cut out for doing really interesting things. And I think, you know, Hubert Joly, the former CEO of Best Buy, he always said it beautifully, right? This idea that the unexpected shows who you really are, because then you kind of have to in some way navigate situations that you're not that used to. And so the long story short really is I would really build that muscle for the unexpected, because the unexpected will happen. And in those unexpected moments, people look to us. If we are leaders, especially, they will look to us. If we're parents, our kids will look to us in unexpected moments. And so it's even small moments, right? The car breaking down on the street. Like if we now kind of like become, oh my God, this is so bad, everything's bad, our kids pick up on it. Versus if we're like, hey, okay, finally we have some time to connect until the service is coming to pick us up. Now, you know what I mean? Like it's kind of those unexpected moments where we can show real leadership, whatever context we're in.
Beautiful. What a beautiful way to end. This has been extremely insightful and very just beautiful. I am so thankful for your time. And apart from Amazon, where can we buy your book? Or is Amazon the best place to go to?
Well, I'm always a big fan of ordering it from the local bookstore. I think, you know, Amazon has taken away from local bookstores a lot. So I guess I'm a big believer of doing that. But also, yes, Amazon probably is the easiest way to do it. So it's called Connect the Dots, the Art and Science of Creating Good Luck.
Wonderful. Christian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.